Today is Thursday. It's February 28th, 2019. It's 11:13 in the morning. Hi, this is John Williams, and we are the Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record at the studios at WGN Radio in beautiful downtown Chicago. You can hear my radio show from 1 to 3 weekdays on WGN.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of The Business Lunch on WGN and proud Marquette Golden Eagle fan, even when they drop one.
It's Patty Vasquez. I host evenings from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m.
I'm Scott Stannis, a Toro cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune, creator of the comic strip Prickly City, and co-host of the Prickly City podcast right here on WGN+.
Right
Plus.
Here. I'm Eric Zorn. I'm the feisty columnist for the Tribune. I run 3 times a week, and you can find me at the Tribune website.
The doctors say you really should only run 3 times a week because the rest of it, the wear and tear.
You really don't need it, isn't it?
Right. You know, I can't run anymore. The doctors have said I'm never going to be able to run again.
Yeah. Seriously, because of your knees or something?
I've got circulation issues in my leg. And I had some tests this week and they said, you're not getting any better.
That's like Bill Daly. He'll never run again either.
Oh, that's true.
Speaking of which, so the city will soon have its second elected black mayor, its second female mayor, and its first black female mayor. And if the first round were any indicator, the next mayor will be gay, too. Quick show of hands or voices. Who knew that Tony Preckwinkle and Lori Lightfoot would be the top two vote-getters in Tuesday's Chicago mayoral election?
Well, I didn't know that Preckwinkle was going to be number two. I thought it was going to be Mendoza, but I did win our office pool by predicting Lightfoot was going to win.
So. I really thought, in fact, I told one of those lakefront liberals Tuesday, I said, you know, you guys all love Lori Lightfoot, but there are only 6 of you. I was shocked that she won.
Think about the constituencies she represented, though. Her personal politics are pretty broad across the city
and
right
now.
And
she did very well in my neighborhood. I was actually a judge of elections in my precinct and
you
ward.
You were. That was so awesome. Cool. She doesn't just talk the talk, ladies and gentlemen. She walks the walk.
And judges the judges. And eats the donuts.
So many donuts and muffins. But my ward is pretty conservative, fairly white, a lot of cops and firefighters. And I got to see the numbers just based on the voters in my ward, and Lori Lightfoot came in second behind Daly, which I was very surprised by. I think she got like 19% in my ward.
Wow. No, yeah. I thought Lightfoot, that was a prediction, but I didn't think, I thought Preckwinkle was tanking. I thought it was going to be Daly.
I thought it was going to be Daly and Preckwinkle.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be Daly for sure.
Name recognition means something. Money means something. Blah, blah, blah.
Lightfoot was on fire in that last week between the debacle with that run-in with Representative Martwick and one of her managers or campaign managers, you know, posting this really horrible comment or picture.
Well, that was Preckwinkle who did that, right? You said Lightfoot was on fire.
Yeah, because of the Preckwinkle,
Everybody else just had so much negative coverage in the last 2 weeks, either from their opponents or the Tribune.
Everyone was talking about Lightfoot that last week.
Tell me what the bad thing was that we were all kicking around about Lori Lightfoot.
About Lori Lightfoot? Yeah.
Lying to a judge. That was sort of coming out. No, it was.
It was a long time ago, and she said she was just following the guidance of her supervisors, and she was a young U.S. attorney.
And that led to one of the problems, because Preckwinkle's aide put up and said the Nazi said the same thing.
I missed that storyline.
Okay. Oh, the Nuremberg trials. Right.
There might be a story in the late Jerry Joyce advertising? I mean, he didn't show up anywhere, and then he was on this radio station a lot in the last week or 10 days, right? And the thought is that he siphoned votes from Bill Daly from the Southwest side, and that he might have been the difference in Daly.
The counter-narrative to that is that the people who were supporting Joyce, that a lot of working people, a lot of union people were not supporting Daly because he was talking about his interest in trying to open up the pensions, that he wants to change the pension clause in the state constitution, and this would hurt public worker pensions, and the unionized workers are not in favor of that. I don't know that that's true. I was puzzled by the Joyce campaign because I wasn't sure what he thought his path to victory was. He never polled very well. He was spending a lot of money on ads, but he didn't do well. If anyone saw any of the forums or watching the debates, he was just sort of blah in those forums. He was pretty good with our debate, though.
He was not a great guest.
I thought he was pretty unimpressive. Really.
What do you think of Patty?
He was not a great guest. I mean, I had him on. I know some other hosts had him on. It was tough to get. I mean, he seemed nervous and flummoxed. But I also think being at the top of the ticket might have helped.
Well, he finished
the number one.
Did he finish? He finished in the top 7 or so, didn't
yeah.
he?
Well, he didn't have 10%. I mean, my line of demarcation was...
Well, he had 9%, and Bill Daley certainly would have loved a couple of those.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right.
Did he beat Mendoza or not? I didn't remember looking at the last... Yeah.
No,
I don't think he did either. But Mendoza, I mean, the two very big disappointments for the night were Mendoza and Chico in terms of what they were expecting and what the polls were telling them they might do. And I think both of them had reasonable hopes of being in that final two, and both of them just, like,
nothing
there.
Especially
happened
Gary.
There.
It just was nothing there.
Yeah.
Well, Mendoza came in with such enthusiasm. I really thought that she's going to be one of the final two. That's no question about it, you know, because I'm a prognosticator and I say things like that. And man, was I wrong.
Be they right or not.
Right.
Yeah. I've gone down that road before. Well, then what do we think of the final two candidates? Is this a good, you know, did the system distill two really good choices for Chicago?
I don't know. I guess it's definitely two paths, right? You've got someone who's part of the machine, and that's going to be a big part of the conversation, and Lori Lightfoot, who everyone seems to think represents progress more than Preckwinkle. I think that they both, you know, are representative of a lot of desires. I heard Lori Lightfoot's conversation this morning, and it sounds like she's cobbling together some of the other messages from the other campaigns, like whatever's left over.
I know that Tony Preckwinkle is the chairwoman of the Democratic Party. I know that. But how, you tell me, Eric and Scott, how machiney is she? Because, I mean, she had always been a social do-gooder, I thought.
It's very interesting to look back at the history because she started the Reform Caucus. She was one of the five people, she'll tell you this many times, who voted against the parking meter deal. She was not a get-along-go-along part of the machine. And, you know, the machine is held together with chewing gum and rubber bands these days.
It's not
what it was by any means. The machine, but there is this organization. Go ahead, Patty.
No, I think that the fact that she came in second shows that the machine might have been working pretty well.
I mean, this is if you take a really broad view of like the institutional
maybe the establishment is a better word.
Establishment is probably better than machine. And you know, she's going to have a lot of public union support, but I don't think Lori Lightfoot is an enemy of the public union. You're going to see like a very bitter campaign fought over very small differences, and it's going to be a lot of who's the insider, who's the outsider, who's the true voice of change, and who's going to just keep things going the way they are. It's not going to be fought on a lot of policy grounds, because I don't think there's a huge difference in the way these two women approach policy.
But to say that Preckwinkle's not part of the machine, part of the establishment, whatever word you want to use, is absurd. I mean, she's a fourth ward hack. She gave the unions everything they wanted and more during negotiations as president of the county commission. You know, she's clearly part of that machine. So, you know, the delineation between her and Lightfoot is pretty strong in that regard. There was no candidate running who would have been like someone who said, I'm going to go against all of destroy the dominant paradigm, and I'm going to get rid of corruption. I'm going to actually care about the money I'm spending. I'm not going to put us more in debt, but less.
Well, did we miss a chance here? I mean, was there somebody that we thought, oh man, it's too bad,
no,
because they would have been our savior, right? I mean,
no.
I'm still asking you guys, if we distilled two good choices for the people of Chicago, this is a big deal.
I think both women are going to be good mayors. I'd say either one is going to be a good mayor.
In the context of the city, in city politics, they're two very good candidates.
What do we say about the fact that, what was the final voter turnout? What did it hold at 30%?
34. It was 33, 34. It did not break a record for the lowest turnout.
Well, come on, guys. Well, but does it matter that much? We had this conversation briefly on the radio. I mean, it's sort of like the primaries that people don't get that interested in 4-year elections, but then they show up maybe for the general election. The runoff is the one that I suspect will get a higher number, right?
It did last time. When Chuy Garcia and Rahm Emanuel were in the runoff, they got like 42%, I want to say.
Citywide, we ran a thing in the Trib that says that that's absolutely true. There's usually a tick up of 8 to 10%.
I get that. But, I mean, 4 years ago, Rahm Emanuel was running for re-election. There was a question of whether there would be a runoff. He was going to be one of the two. In this one, it seemed to have been wide open. I thought there would be more people wanting to have their say.
I did a column on that for this morning, and it talked about how this. They notice this in business as well. So it's called the paralysis of choice, which is you have so many things to choose from that you can't choose, and you just go, I can't choose, it's too much. And they find this in things like salad dressing or jams at the
jellies.
Store.
I feel like it's too much stuff. That's why I told you that on Tuesday night. That was the conversation we were having. Is that given too many choices, people choose nothing?
Malcolm Gladwell wrote about that, right? Where the lady that had the jams in her store, if she only had three. She sold a lot of jelly. People go apple or cherry or whatever. But then she said, let's put 100 and really expand our revenue base. And then sales went down because people were overwhelmed and they bought nothing. But if you said you want grape, strawberry, or apple, they can pick one of those. 14 different jams, I don't know.
Yeah, so there's some research that says that five is about the overload.
Is that
point.
It?
Yeah,
is
you have five choices, and then after that, people are like, oh, I can't make a choice.
Boy, the National Democrats are screwed.
I talked to people on Tuesday who were headed to the polls and weren't sure who they were going to vote for.
I stood before that piece of paper and made the decision as I stroked the pen.
And
literally, that was the process.
Really?
I was that
Wow.
The one person we're not talking about who was actually didn't win, but he won the most number of precincts, and that's Willie Wilson. Is he a player in this? I mean, if he comes out and says, I endorse L squared.
I put this question to the listeners during the coverage. I said, who's Willie Wilson going to back? Neither of these candidates are Willie Wilson style. I mean, he's basically a Republican, okay? I mean, he said he voted for Trump. He supported Rauner. I mean, he doesn't really admit to it anymore, but he's a Republican. So neither of these two candidates are Republican adjacent.
But they both called him that night, election night, and then both said,
we always loved you. You were always my second choice.
Is he really a player?
And I think he will continue to milk it for the rest of up to the runoff, and he'll make them dance for the...
So are you telling me the people that voted for Willie Wilson, whoever, for whatever reason, will transfer their vote to Lori Lightfoot or Tony Preckwinkle because he suggests that?
I think that'll be the hope from the candidates.
I guess so.
I think so. I think if he gets up on the podium and holds hands and raises the joined hands together with one of those two women, I think that can help. I don't know how much endorsements like that or newspaper endorsements or anything make a difference. But
one last thing about the personal politics here. Does Lori Lightfoot being a gay, female, African-American help or hurt or matter at all? Is that kind of a neutral point, since her other opponent is also a female and African American?
I have heard the theory that she's not going to get the black church lady vote on the South Side, and the fact that she didn't do all that well in the black ward suggests that maybe that is a factor. I think it was on Patty's show, though, Hermine was saying that's the old way. Thinking about it, the new way is that they won't that won't be held against her. I don't know. I don't.
Black churches tend to be, and this is
very
my experience,
conservative,
very conservative socially, and I think that's going to be a problem. That could be a problem there. I think she's just a really strong candidate.
She's
really
smart.
Her presence. And you look at these two, and this is ultimately the nut graph. Is ultimately you look at these two, and you can see either of them being mayor of the city.
Absolutely.
And that's where, but then that plays to Lori Lightfoot's advantage, because she's not some firebrand, outsider.
Her body language is really bad.
Think about this. If Lori Lightfoot is elected mayor, we will have a black woman mayor. We'll have a black woman on the head of the county board. We'll have a black woman state's attorney. We'll have a black woman running the Chicago Public Schools.
Lieutenant governor.
The lieutenant governor, the treasurer, the county clerk. I mean, the black women even no matter what happens, black women have a lot of power in this area. it's kind of cool.
See?
You think about how the years of white men have had it, and we haven't even
Latina's
noticed.
Latina's got a lot
I
of
want to amend what I said
That's
about
true.
Lori Lightfoot's body language, too, and that is
it's not
that
a competition.
She's,
it feels like it.
When Lori comes into the studio, she's just so retiring, and she's so petite. When she talks, she's really good. I think she gave me a terrific interview. She did you, too.
Yeah, she's very serious and incredibly
and seems to know her stuff.
Dynamic,
and is really, all of that, but when she walks into a room, she's not a stacker of wheat, this Lori Lightfoot. It'll just be interesting.
Yeah, some of the photos people have of her bundled up, and she's...
It will be the biggest height differential, any race in the
that
country.
That is not what you would expect a mayor of Chicago to look like. But
Scott's going to have a field day, the cartoonist with a tall and the short candidate.
Well, we've had a tiny mayor for pocket-sized mayors for generations.
Since the last one who didn't fit in a pocket was Harold Washington, right?
Yeah,
maybe so. Michael Cohen has testified before the House Oversight Committee. It's been riveting. Has it been productive? I don't know. I don't know that we need to care. It's just been dramatic television. Yeah. And Republicans get a chance to call him a liar, and Democrats get a chance to ask embarrassing questions that have no answers because we don't know if we can trust him. I think a question posed nationally in a lot of the surveys was, who do you trust more, the president or his former attorney? Scott, what's your reaction to Michael Cohen's testimony this week?
I think it's hard to take seriously a guy who's testifying, who's going to jail for lying to Congress as he talks to Congress. I tell people this is very sexy stuff, and it is, but the thing you have to take away from this is the physical evidence he introduced, and those are the checks signed by the president as he's president, as the president was lying to us. Now, I've been on conservative radio the last couple of days talking about this, saying we should be as furious about that. We right-wingers should be as furious about that as when another president waggled his finger as, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. It's infuriating. It's not against the law, but he lied to us. And why aren't you mad about this? And finally, the host, one of them kind of grudgingly said, well, I guess we should think about that. I go, okay.
I just think it's delicious that the Republican members of Congress are saying they shouldn't believe Cohen because he's a proven liar.
But here we are today, our first big hearing, with, as you and we all know, a convicted liar, lying to Congress, a criminal. And I believe this witness is totally incompatible.
Yeah, right.
While they support Donald Trump.
The ranking member.
Elijah Cummings?
No, the ranking member of the
Jordan?
Of the committee.
No, Jim Jordan?
Why wasn't he wearing a coat? I know it's weird. I know it's
he
a weird
does.
Observation.
It's dramatic.
I think that's Jordan, and I think he never does.
He's working hard for the people.
Right. He's got his sleeves rolled up. Scott.
Doesn't want to be inhibited.
It's only lazy people like me who are...
I also think the committee things also show just how ugly... And it was, if you went to Central Casting and say, okay, get the whitest, meanest, angriest congressman you can get and put him on camera and make them Republicans, I mean, it just...
And give him a black woman as a prop.
Yeah, bring in a black woman.
She's not as prop, she said.
Somebody explain that, because I know the
story
we're talking
about. So Meadows said to Michael Cohen, do you recognize this woman behind me, this African-American woman? Yes, she's, and I don't recall her name, but she works in the Trump administration. Cohen said, I was responsible for hiring her. She's African-American. And Meadows says, well, she says that she's the son of someone from Montgomery, Alabama. I think it was Montgomery. And she would never work for a racist. So she's standing there behind Meadows. She can't speak. She's got no standing to speak. So she was a prop. I mean, she was a prop, and she might not feel that way herself, but that's the way it was used. And then there was a freshman Minnesota.
Congresswoman from Michigan.
Who called him out on it, seemed to call him a racist. And
No. She said, you know,
did something racist.
It was a racist thing to do.
Okay,
but it wasn't racist.
Just because someone has a person of color, a black person working for them, does not mean they are racist. And it is insensitive that someone would even say it is racist in itself, and to use a black woman as a prop to prove it otherwise. And I can submit this for the record. If a colleague is thinking that that's what I'm saying, I'm just saying that's what I believe to have happened. And if, as a person of color in this committee, that's how I felt at that moment, and I wanted to express that.
My favorite part of that was when Elijah Cummings, the African-American chairman, spoke of Meadows and said, you know, a lot of people don't like it or don't want to hear it, but you're my best friend here. You know, that these two guys who are so, you know, Meadows is from the Freedom Caucus. They're so diametrically opposed politically, and they were expressing, you know, their bromance for each other, which
yes.
was nice.
Do you have to get that, John?
Yeah, pardon me.
But, I mean...
Sorry, Steve, you were making a really good point.
I don't think I was, so you're better
sure.
off.
Well, I thought that the optics on that were stupid.
It just
How
didn't
did
make
he
sense,
think that was going to play out?
Why would... I don't understand what he was
That's
thinking.
Actually, some of my best friends
are black.
I know. Fill in the blank.
Yeah. Right, and if you don't believe me, why, here's one now, who I won't let speak.
But that's the thing about Cohen, is he says, well, you know... Trump is a racist, he's a con man, he's a scoundrel, and then they say, well, what do you have to, can you prove this? He says, well, I just, you know, look at his staff. He's like,
well,
that doesn't answer the question.
No, his proof, it's not documentation, but if his proof is that, you know, that he asked Cohen to name a country led by a black person that was in a shithole, I mean, that's direct testimony, you know. For that.
And saying, he said that, according to Cohen, he said that black people weren't going to vote for him because they were too stupid.
They're too stupid. I mean, those are things that he's saying that Donald Trump told him. He doesn't have recordings of them, and then so you're going to say he's lied before.
Yeah.
If I have to pick who's lied more, if I have to pick a liar in this fight,
They are. That's,
well, he's under. He's. I mean, I know he lied under oath before, but he's. if he comes into. I mean, I believe.
It sounds so silly.
I believe what he's saying. I believe that, you know. I think he's telling the truth because he would putting himself. He's got 3 years in prison or something like that.
Right.
He's putting himself in jeopardy of more by coming in if he tells more lies. I mean, does anybody? I mean, the thing is, yeah, we already know that Trump is a con man and a racist, and we already know these things. It's baked into the price of Trump, and he still has his 33 whatever. Percent of people who support
ultimately,
him.
I don't think it matters. Ultimately, it doesn't change. It doesn't move the needle one way or the other for what, regardless so, of how you feel
things,
about the
and this thing just the other day in North Korea, where he stands up for North Korea and saying that he doesn't. Was it what's the kid's name? Warmbier, Otto Warmbier.
Kid.
He's just like, I asked him about that. He didn't. You know, Kim didn't know about that.
A lot of people in North Korea.
Did Kim Jong Un tell you?
He felt badly about it. Speak to him. He felt very badly, but he knew the case very well. But he knew it later.
You know, a lot of people.
Those jails are tough.
And he believed the Saudis, and he believed Putin. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy Trump is. I mean, he's a dictator in weight. He really, really loves those guys. He wants to believe them so much, and it's just I can't believe people are still sticking by him and not selling shows. But they do.
To his credit, he did leave Vietnam. Without some sort of
I thought
sham
that was a smart
deal.
Play. I thought that was a smart play. I also think he was anxious to get back here because all the cameras were over here instead of over there.
Right, what and to pout.
This guy's a deal maker. He goes over there. Anybody knows the first thing about diplomacy. You don't have these summits without everything being worked out in
That's
advance.
That's old school. Yeah. No, you go over there and you say, hey, I'm here. And I think it was the plan to walk out early. Know, I mean, he really... Kim is going to agree to completely denuclearize.
Well, he said he did last time.
Okay, so fine. I think, but I think the truth is known by everybody, and so he goes over there, and if he hits a home run, fine. But I think they had the plane on idle the whole time, just figuring, you know, that's part of his negotiation. You know what else is part of his negotiation? Is the sucking up to Kim, saying, but he's a great guy, and it's offensive to us to hear that. But I think ultimately that will play on that little boy in North Korea's mind. He's going to go, oh, all right. Okay. I actually think that it operates on such a juvenile level.
Unless he is as ignorant as Trump, he will not fall for that because he knows the only reason he gets a summit with this little tiny country, right? I mean, North Korea is this poor, tiny little crappy country. And the only reason he gets a summit with the president of the United States is because they've got their nukes. He gives up his nukes, he's going to be pulled out of a rat hole like Saddam. You know, he knows that, or he's going to be killed like Gaddafi. He is not unless he's really dumb. He's not going to agree to give up his nukes.
Scott, what do you think?
I was going to say walking away is really smart, but it's also he's following a script that we watched in the late mid '80s, which was Reykjavik. Remember, President Reagan and Gorbachev met. Last minute, they couldn't come to terms, and Reagan left. But what happened later? Surprise, surprise! Is they signed one of the best nuclear disarmament treaties in the generation of peace.
I mean, that's an interesting parallel because that really was a last minute summit, I think the difference is both sides there went wanting something. I just don't know that North Korea. Was willing to play.
Well, they wanted the end of the sanctions.
They want the sanctions, Dan.
Oh, I guess they want something, but were they really willing to give nuclear weapons? And I don't think they ever would.
Yeah,
right.
That would be insane. Look what we did to Gaddafi. Gets rid of his weapons, and we kill him.
By the way, I went to, when I was in Iceland a couple years ago, you can go to Hafti House. Remember the pictures? Ronald Reagan coming out to greet Gorbachev.
Yeah.
Gorbachev in his big winter coat and Reagan in his his jacket, his blazer. It's so cool. You can stand on those steps and everything.
It's so cool for you,
but
you're kind of an old Soviet wonk. That's really cool to you, Steve.
I've got pictures on my phone. I'll show you.
I'm going to pass.
I'm sure I do.
I just want to go back though and wrap it up on the Cohen testimony. I talked to Congresswoman Robin Kelly from Chicago a little while ago, just before we walked into here today. And we were talking about the purpose of this Cohen hearing. And I said to her, so what really are you guys doing, right? Because it's like Stormy Daniels, and there was a check, and he lies.
And maybe apartments in Moscow.
Maybe he had a love child, and maybe he hit Melania, but he's got the tape, but he won't release the tape. Does he have a tape of him hitting Melania in an elevator? It was going back and forth like that, and I thought, what is the purpose of Steve, I'm trying to make a point here about the Cohen testimony.
I found the picture of my Hofty house.
Well, now you're walking the phone around to everybody.
Slide it. You'll see where you're going to Gorbachev and the other one.
Okay, good. I'll get to that. So I thought, what is the purpose of these hearings? And she says, well, we're oversight. We just oversee the executive branch, and it's our job to just check on him, see how he's doing. It's such a broad...
Oh, they're laying a predicate to subpoena his tax records.
Right, that seemed to be pretty good.
And get him on insurance fraud. I mean, they opened up a lot of doors, a little bit of a crack.
Yeah, a little bit.
This is just beginning.
But it's a fishing expedition then, right? It's like, what can we get... Like, I thought that everybody was focused on, is there collusion, or at least did the Russians hack the U.S. election, and how can we prevent that? To me, that should be the focus of Mueller and all of these hearings. That's the thing that we should worry about and try and prevent in the future. And but they've got this thing, and they're just asking Cohen anything under the sun to embarrass the
president.
Doesn't
it seem likely to you from what Cohen said? Cohen said that Trump tends to talk in what he called code,
yes,
where he says like he knows that Cohen is dealing with a Russian thing, and he looks at him and says, I have no business dealings with Russia, which is how he tells him. You know, it's like you have a nice store here. I hate to have something happen to it. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's like the worst like gangster code you can think of that he's talking in. But so he probably has plausible deniability on any kind of coordination or with the Russians, right? I mean, he probably never said the words. He probably just. You know, is what he didn't
Cohen
say.
He says stuff like, I like your tie today or something, which yeah. I don't know quite how that translated.
I believed Cohen's testimony.
I did too.
But this will sound so partisan. I'm sorry, but I didn't believe Kavanaugh's testimony. Kavanaugh was fulminating and angry and shouting back.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election. I will not be intimidated into withdrawing from this process.
And Cohen was like, yep, I lied. I screwed up. I'm ashamed. You want to know the truth? Here it is.
And if you believe him, you're going to end up like me.
I know. Well, that
is very powerful.
Well, and I think the dynamics are different too, because Kavanaugh was fighting for something that, you know, he believed he was entitled to, whereas Cohen is, you know.
And with Kavanaugh, we had his yearbook. Yeah. I mean,
and his calendar.
It was interesting to see Ocasio-Cortez surface asking what really was an interesting question, because if we get a chance to examine more closely a case for campaign violations, if we have to or checks that were handed back and forth, if that means we have to look at Donald Trump's taxes, wow, that will be fascinating.
She was going after, I think, insurance fraud, wasn't she?
I know it was a financial deal.
Well, it was a financial deal, and it was funny because I was kind of waiting for her to just unload on him with something, you know, AOC like, you know, spectacular, and she just like came in like a prosecutor, very surgical and quiet, and spent 5 minutes, and it just seemed like she was like opening a few doors and said, okay, thank you, that's it.
To your knowledge, did the president ever provide inflated assets to an insurance company?
Yes.
Who else knows that the president did this?
Alan Weisselberg, Ron Lieberman, and Matthew Calamari.
And where would the committee find more information on this? Do you think we need to review his financial statements and his tax returns in order to compare them?
Yes, and you'd find it at the Trump Org.
Thank you very much.
I know.
Got a bunch of names of people that they might want to subpoena.
Yeah,
I thought that was a very interesting time.
Yeah, that was, I think, well played. And the less news she makes about herself, I think the better it is for
her
and everybody. There was a Jussie Smollett editorial cartoon that was taken down. It was in the, and Scott, you're going to help me out with this now. It was in the San Diego...
Union Tribune,
and it was about Jussie Smollett and two other great African-American storytellers, whose names escape me now. Do you guys remember?
Baldwin and Morrison, I believe.
Tony Morrison
and James Baldwin.
And it says, here's another great African-American storyteller. And they asked the cartoonist they took that cartoon down.
Yeah.
From their website. What did you think about
it? I thought it was a dumb cartoon to begin with. I mean, it's a false equivalency. I get the process, and I understand what Steve Breen, who's a good guy, and I know him, but it seemed like, here's a storyteller. Who else are storytellers? Okay, this guy, and you made this. First off, it doesn't make a very strong point, other than that Jussie Smollett told a tall tale. So I'm not sure what the cartoon was supposed to accomplish, but it wasn't a very good cartoon. That's when the editor steps in and says, yeah, you know.
So you support that editorial oversight?
Well, I have it. Yeah.
I know that, but do you have it to the degree that if they, go, yeah, that cartoon doesn't work for me. I'm a little offended. I'm going to pull it down. I mean, I didn't know that they would. Eric, do they sometimes take one of your columns and after it's been posted say, we're taking so much heat for this column that we're now going to take it back?
No, that they never would do that with a column. I've never heard of that.
But
happening.
It also shows you the age of the
editors. I'm sure they have. Not they, the Tribune, but I'm sure that print publications have pulled things
down. Once something's online, why pull it?
It was Black History Month. It's also, you know, very condescending and diminishing.
And James Baldwin and Toni Morrison are revered Americans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to, like you said, the false equivalency of putting up this guy who was abusing his race to try to get a raise is you know, incredibly insulting.
And it suggests something insincere or phony about
it implies
Baldwin and
that
Morrison.
They, right.
Yes.
There's something bad about them. Yeah. I mean, the idea of the thing is, I think Scott made this point, which is like the editor needs to sort of look at that and kind of save a cartoonist or a columnist. And I don't know if you feel this way, Scott, but I've been saved by my editors before, where they say, like, you know, and it's usually not an entire column. It'll be like a paragraph. An editor will say, you know how this is. In fact, I'll say this. Just the other day, I described Susana Mendoza as feisty in a column because, you know, an editor said to me, she said, you know, I know what you're saying here, but that word, it has sexist connotations like that. And I said, yeah, you know, you're right. He said, how about scrappy? I said, perfect. You know, that's all I was getting at. I wasn't trying to. But this is the kind of thing that good editors do that. They see something and go like, you know what? You may not want to use that word.
I love that oversight. That's very interesting to me.
It's our safety net.
Oh, that we would have that on the radio.
Totally grateful.
John, they pulled your entire show Monday off the air.
Yeah. Surprise.
It's not on the stream anymore.
No, really. But feisty, to me, connotes female and whatever else goes with it. Is the point there, right?
I used to use it all the time when I was with Bill and Wendy. I would say that's how I'd introduce myself. And I'd say, I'm the feisty columnist. And I kind of thought it was just a good, you know, good word for someone who's confrontational and you know, loud. And but
you can't control how it's heard.
And you know, and I think, yeah, and I think, yeah, you know, and you know, even reading this room, I think it was the right call, and I'm grateful for it because I didn't want to. It wasn't like that's the point of my column. My point of my column is just, no, it's like just a throwaway adjective.
But at the time in the San Diego paper where that column ran, we were all still grappling with, is Smollett telling the truth? And by the way, technically, he's not been convicted of any crime. Nobody's proven that Jussie Smollett is telling a tall tale. But this guy says, oh, no, we're not buying it. You're telling a story here. And then he juxtaposes it with two other great African-American storytellers. And when I first saw the cartoon, I kind of laughed. I got his point. I didn't for a minute think it impugned the integrity of the other African-American storytellers as if to say they're liars or they peddle falsehoods. I didn't think that at all. And then everybody reminded me that, oh, no, that was a terrible thing. And so while I get that, I wasn't put off or especially offended, at least not at first blush, by that cartoon.
No, there are worse things, surely. But in this instance, it just wasn't this is one time if you have a good editor, and I'm lucky enough to have one, who will say, this doesn't make sense. What are you saying?
Yeah,
and if you can tell me what you're saying in like a sentence, then it's a good cartoon. If you can't, then it's back to the drawing board.
Since we last met, I'll just close with this topic today: the Oscars. Steve Bertrand is the keeper of too much Oscar talk, and I thought I had a brilliant connection.
Okay,
from the Oscars to the mayoral race in Chicago. The Green Book won Best Motion Picture at the Oscars, and some people are upset about that for a variety of reasons. I took Monday off, so I'm driving around listening to Bill and Wendy, listening to the Steve Cochran Show. I listened to NPR, and all of them did lengthy segments about Green Book winning, and was that good or was that a travesty? I mean, maybe that was just really bad. None of them talked about how the Oscars are voted upon, and they use ranked choice voting. They use ranked choice voting. You don't say what's the best picture. You say what's your first choice for best picture, what's your second choice for best picture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that favors broad-based populist stuff. That's the reason they have it in some cities and states for elections of human beings. We won't get these incendiary, polarizing people. It'll force the candidates to work more towards the middle. I think that's what happened with the Oscars. It was a good movie. I thoroughly enjoyed the movie. I understand why it was offensive to some people, but I think if you said, what's the broad swath in the middle, ranked choice voting tends to distill that. So that was my little speech.
That is true, what you said. Now, we don't know if that's what happened because the Academy never reveals how
the
votes go.
I'd love
go.
To see how the votes went. What was first? What was second?
But that tends
third?
To be true. I mean, well, but you know, Moonlighting won a couple of years ago, right? The whole La La Land.
Moonlight.
What's it called? Moonlighting is the comedy.
Sybil Shepherd.
Anyway, there's my entertainment reporter cred out the window. But I mean, and that I don't think that didn't seem like a middle brow movie to me. That seemed like a daring.
Well, look at Shape of Water from the year before. The Shape of Water was nobody's broad brush mainstream all American movie, and that
artsy.
One. So my theory is tested at times, but at least that's I think for political purposes how we would benefit from ranked choice voting. The problem is nobody understands it, and the more I explain it, the less they understand it.
Trust me, there are 20 minutes of my life, I'll never get that.
Our recommendations this week are what? Patty, what are you reading or smoking or...
Wow. It's not legal yet.
Or injecting
it?
Or...
Wow. All right.
Wait, we should just... Are we all thumbs up on legalized marijuana as a way to at least add to the state's coffers?
No.
You're not, no?
Well, people, there will be more coffers in the state. Yes.
Well played, sir.
Recommendation, miss.
I can't remember what I recommended last week. I'm going to go with Sex Education, which is running on Netflix with Gillian Anderson. It's a little bit tawdry, so if you're appalled by nudity, you might want to.
But isn't it with kids?
Yeah, it's the teenagers. Yeah, his mom.
The teenager's naked?
Yeah.
Did you all see Roma? Did you all see the movie Roma?
No.
There's full frontal male nudity in this, and it's in a scene where the guy does a jiu-jitsu kind of martial arts performance, and he's got no clothes on, and you see him and it for a while. And my friend Lou Manfredini was so put off by that. He was really offended by it.
There's a great show on Amazon right now called The Informer, or just Informer, and it's a British kid. He's a Pakistani heritage, and he gets busted for a small possession of drugs. This girl he was with starts to OD, brings her to the hospital. The cops start talking to him. He really doesn't. He's not a bad guy. He's a good guy. But the cops find a way to get some influence on him, and then they force him into becoming an informer for them, and he has to infiltrate these terror cells in London. And it's 6 1-hour episodes. Very good. You don't really know who the bad guy. We know there's a terror attack, but we don't know who commits it really until the last moment of the show. It's called Informer, and I would strongly recommend that.
How much male nudity is in it?
There was one scene where, but it was they didn't show anything.
Oh, no thanks then.
The Brit referred to it as, I was standing there with my flapper out.
I'll jump in here, Steve, while you're there. Say Nothing is the new book about the Troubles in Northern Ireland, a kidnapping of and a murder of a woman. And I know that's part of the
world.
The book so far, and I'm always reviewing books 30 pages in or 50 pages in, but I've been reading it, and the writer's a good writer, and Say Nothing is the story of a woman who is kidnapped and killed as part of the fight in Northern Ireland. And so far, that's my recommendation. There goes them. So how about you, Mr. Zorn? What are you liking this week?
Joanna and I watched the first two episodes of This Is Us on Hulu. It's the NBC series. Do you, anyone else watch that? No?
Yeah.
You didn't like it? I mean, the first two episodes were pretty interesting.
I'm surprised you're just now getting to that.
Yeah, well.
That's been out for a while, you know.
We have kids, you know. I know they're grown, but.
Oh, you're going to love it. You're going to have a great run with that thing.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
The first two episodes were intriguing, and if you remember back, there's a couple of like surprise cliffhangers at the end of both first two episodes, so I'm wondering where it's going to go. So you like it?
I didn't. But
you didn't?
But my wife did, and I know a lot of people who really got caught up in that, so I'm wishing you a pleasant journey.
How much of it did you watch?
Like half a season.
Okay.
I just don't have time for that kind of TV. I don't know why. It just didn't capture me. Dude, but you know how it is, like when somebody goes, okay, I'm just now sitting down to Mad Men, and they have not watched Mad Men, and you're just so, you know how much fun you had watching Mad Men, and you're like, oh,
yes.
I know you're about to have a really fun trip. Enjoy the journey as I did Mad Men too.
My mom is addicted to the Good Wife, and she oh my god! And then he died, and she's just having. I'm like, it's you know, it's
the clothes
been off the
on the Good Wife
years.
Are just. I love the fashion in the Good Wife.
We
too.
Watched all 7 seasons after it had already ended. We sat down and watched all 7 seasons.
Yeah.
Scott Stannis recommendation.
Wow, I feel recommending a book of poetry.
Nerd.
Carl Severn. We were. I took a trip with my family. I met my wife and I met my son and his wife in Amsterdam. We had an Airbnb on one of the canals, and I said, I'm not going to check social media. I'm not going to look at the news. I'm not going to partake in any of that. I brought a book of poetry. I brought two graphic novels and a book of Carl Sandburg poetry, which I had not read before.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, he's a good one, isn't he?
Yeah, he's pretty decent.
And it was just delightful to just unplug entirely and just, be in this interesting new environment, but more importantly, reading this poetry that I had not, American poetry I had not read before.
I've been reading some lately, too, and it does take you to a place you don't normally go.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Any male nudity in this poem?
That wraps it up. That's Eric Zorn, Scott Stannis. Thank you, Patty Vasquez.
Thank you.
Steve Bertrand. We're produced by L.F. Garris. I'm John Williams. Thanks for listening. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.